Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, November 17th. A record 142 women are projected to serve in the United States Congress next year. That's still low out of 535, but 142 will still be a record, and 35 of them are expected to be Republican women, the most in party history. Not only that, many of these new GOP congresswomen flip Democratic seats in hard-fought districts. One of them is from New York City, as many of you know, Nicole Malliotakis, who defeated incumbent Democrat Max Rose. Malliotakis has made national news since Election Day, saying she plans to start her own conservative version of the Squad dedicated to anti-socialism. Joining us now is Olivia Perez-Cubas. She is the former communications director for Senator Marco Rubio and now holds the same role at the Winning for Women Action Fund, the first super PAC dedicated to electing Republican women. Ms. Perez-Cubas, thank you for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start this in 2008, which was pegged as the year of the woman due to the record number of women elected to Congress that year? But in that year, only one was a Republican, I believe. So what changed from 2018 to 2020?
Yeah, so, you know, our super PAC was very much launched in response to the 2018 midterm elections, where, as you said, only one Republican woman was newly elected to the House. And we really asked ourselves at the time why this was happening, why a record number of Republican women had run for office, but so few were able to make it out of their primary election and even fewer out of their general election. So we asked ourselves why this was happening. And one of the biggest things that we noticed was that Republicans lacked an infrastructure to help support Republican women candidates from recruitment through their primary, through their general election. And we really lagged behind the left in terms of support for women, particularly in large part due to Emily's List. And there was kind of a hole in the Republican political ecosystem there. So we launched the Super PAC to help fill that hole. But I also think in large part due to another New York Congresswoman, Elise Stefanik, who really sounded the alarm and kind of rallied the party behind this need to elect more women and support more women. Party leadership got behind it. We had the support of several members, several other groups within the political infrastructure. And, you know, our group and these efforts really made all the difference because, as you said, it has been a record year for Republican women this cycle. More women than ever before are newly elected to the House. More women, Republican women than ever before, will be in Congress in both chambers. And we're really proud. We're really proud of the gains that we've made. And we also think it's just the beginning.
From what I read, you didn't, or Congresswoman Stefanik's efforts to recruit women through her political action committee didn't have the blessing or the backing of the National Republican Congressional Committee. The chairman, Minnesota Republican Tom Emmer, when asked about Congresswoman Stefanik's efforts, said he thought it was a mistake. So what was that about, in your opinion?
Yeah, that was, I'm not sure. I do think the party has always focused rightfully on making sure that we are electing people based off qualifications and that they are the best fits for their district. And I think the Congresswoman's point was she agreed, but oftentimes many of those candidates are women. They happen to just lack support that they need to actually win their elections. And she kind of famously responded, I don't know if you remember, but she famously responded saying, you know, I'm not asking for permission. I'm doing this. I'm going forward with this. And we're certainly glad that she did because it worked and it helped make all the difference.
Does that answer suggest a different relationship to identity or identity politics, if you will, among Republican women, even though they seem to be dismissed by Republican men?
I think, you know, the Republican Party has long eschewed identity politics, right? But elites and groups like ours helped make the case that this is not identity politics, that A, we are recruiting the best of the best, and oftentimes the best will be women, and we want to make sure in those instances that they have support. Also, it's about winning, and one of the best ways that we can broaden our appeal to more women voters, which the party does need, is by electing more women. And also, it's about accuracy. We want to make sure that representation in Congress reflects America and reflects reality, but also reflects the Republican Party. And going back to 2018, electing one new Republican woman, that is not an accurate reflection of this country or the party. And we really needed to make a concerted effort to do a better job on that front.
What kinds of issues or tactics were most successful for getting out the vote in these flipped districts? And were they any different for male Republicans in similar places?
So I think, well, first I want to note that Republicans in the House flipped 11 seats this cycle. 9 of those 11 were by women. And I think that that is an incredibly impressive statistic and proof that when Republicans invest in women, Republicans win. And I think that that will help us build our case going forward. I think what these candidates ran on is really a case-by-case, district-by-district issue here. For example, I know Nicole, one of her big platforms was being against defunding the police. That played really well in her district. You also had a candidate like Maria Salazar down in Florida, a Cuban-American. South Florida has a very big Hispanic population, particularly Cuban-American population. And she ran against socialism. That played very well in her district. So it kind of just depended. I do think each of these candidates did a really good job of running on their message, owning their brand, and they all had really strong campaign teams behind them, and they all showed really good fundraising chops, which are really important when you're running for office. And really, their wins are a testament to the quality of candidate that these women are.
Is there a Trump factor? He's seen as so sexist in so many ways. I could go down a list, you know, starting with maybe when he was campaigning just before the election, talking about the recession and saying, I want to open up the economy so your husbands can go back to work, which is
right.
Inherently sexist, never mind that it's been a more female-oriented recession because of the types of jobs from which people have been laid off. So did the 9 of the 11 flip district candidates who won, who were Republican women, need to run around Trump in a different way than the men?
So also, I think it's no secret that the president kind of it was difficult for him to talk to and suburban women voters, and he very much struggled with that. We saw in his comments, they were very offensive to many people, particularly that one that you just read aloud, where the majority of American workers who were put out of work were actually women since the start of the pandemic. So that's no secret. I do think it's, again, a case-by-case basis. In certain districts, the president is a positive and he's a value add, and in other districts, he's not quite as helpful. I think in, I know like Oklahoma 5 where Stephanie Bice won, the president outperformed her. So again, case by case, but we also have 2 California wins recently by women, Republican women, and they overperformed the president. So really it kind of just depended on what district they were sitting in and the makeup of that district.
As I mentioned earlier, Nicole Malliotakis in New York's 11th district won that race against Max Rose, and she said she hopes to make an anti-socialist squad to counter the progressive quartet of congresswomen in the Democratic Party, led, of course, by another New York congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's Congresswoman-elect Malliotakis being asked about her conception of a squad.
Tell me about this Freedom Squad that you have an idea for.
You know, we don't have a name yet because we're not in high school, but I got to tell you that there is a natural alliance that is occurring here, and we are bonded by the fact that we come from different experiences of socialism. My mother was a Cuban refugee who fled the Castro regime in 1959. Carlos Jimenez is Cuban-born. He came to the America at the age of six. We also have Victoria Spartz, who comes from the Ukraine, grew up under Soviet Union rule. And you also have Maria Elvira Salazar, who is, like me, the daughter of Cuban refugees. And so we have a natural alliance that is forming, and we are bonded by our love of America, our love for freedom and liberty, and the opportunity that the American dream represents. And we want to preserve that.
Nicole Malliotakis, Congresswoman-elect from here in New York. So, Ms. Perez-Cubas, one thing about that clip, Malliotakis has made very clear what her squad would stand against. But what will it stand for? Are there central values that Republican women will stand for in Congress? Or is it more, you know, that they want to own the libs, as they say sometimes in I guess, Trump-supporting world, or they just want to stand against certain kinds of progressive economics that they see as socialist?
I think both are important. I think as you're seeing the left kind of battle internally there, and you have a handful of Congress members trying to kind of pull the party to the left, I think it's important to have voices on the right as a counterweight to those policies and in making sure that they don't get traction, and helping kind of pull politics back toward the middle again. I think a lot of these women, certainly I know they ran on a handful of issues. Number one, COVID, and trying to get the economy back open again as quickly but as safely as possible, which I think Americans across the country hope to see. And certainly there's looking like a light at the end of the tunnel there. Healthcare, you know, I think safety, making sure that their communities are safe. And running against socialism and ensuring that individual liberty and freedom, that none of these things are threatened or at risk. And kind of, like I mentioned earlier, just being a voice for the right.
But then it does sound like it's more of a defensive stance than promoting certain policies to solve certain problems. Am I hearing you right?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think they're going to certainly put forth policies. I'm interested to see how, you know, under Biden administration, what that looks like and the stances that they will need to take. I also think because Republicans are able to flip so many seats, the Democrats have the majority by very little now. So I certainly hope we see some more bipartisanship and what that means. So much of the future of what politics looks like remains in the Senate, where we have yet to see who will keep the Senate, whether Republicans will keep the majority or not. So I think it's a little bit of both, of a defense, but also certainly being proactive and putting other policies forward.
Before we take some of the Republican women calling in, I want to take one from Karen in Benton Township, Pennsylvania, who says she's an independent because she wants to react to what we were just talking about the two competing squads, quote unquote. So, Karen, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Just an observation as an independent that this just sounds so confrontational, and this squad versus that squad, and it just feels like what we were hoping to happen after this election was that there would be some moving together. And as a woman, I feel like this just flies in the face of what I would hope would be true, that women could work together, that women of differing positions, differing policies would be able to work together. And I think the more we talk about socialism and the more we talk about just those hot button words, are just no healing is going to occur, or little healing is going to occur. And I would say the same thing on the Democratic side. I would like to see these two groups see how they can work together and set common goals and not have that, what I sense because I keep looking for how this is going to happen and who will do it, this divisiveness. So thanks a lot. I appreciate the time.
And I appreciate your call. And to that point, Ms. Perez-Cubas, I mean, a stereotype would say women with less need to show macho dominance in general will be more solution-oriented and less about winning and dividing up into camps. So to what Karen in Pennsylvania seems to want, how much do you think having more women on both sides of the aisle now will change the inter-party dynamic or political polarization? Apparently not, based on the clip of Maliotakis. Maybe that's reflective of her district. But what about that idea that women are, you know, less inclined in general to just try to win, and so they're going to have a greater likelihood of working together across the aisle? Or is that a stereotype that you reject?
I think both are true. And I don't mean to kind of dodge, but I do think there's something to be said about women being more willing to reach across the aisle. For example, Joni Ernst, part of her campaign was how bipartisan she is and how she is very willing to reach across the aisle when it meant it would benefit her state and her constituents. I also think we need to be wary of putting all women kind of in a box and saying, oh, because they're women, they will do this or they will do that. Every woman is different. I think every woman's districts or state's needs are different, and she will probably carry herself accordingly, as we just saw with Nicole Maliotakis' clip. But I also, you know, I do think it, with Karen's call, the majority of Americans would agree with her that we, these past few years have been very divisive. And I think going forward, most Americans want to see more unity and want to see more bipartisanship. And I do think with slimmer margins in the House, that might be the only way forward. And that's certainly my hope.
Carol in Norwood in New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add my voice to the Republican women. I've been a Republican since the 1980s. At the time, I was living in St. Louis, Missouri, and I got involved in campaigning for a young man who was actually went against Dick Shephart. We didn't win, but we took about 30% of the vote, and that was exciting to be part of that campaign. And back then, they just explained the platform to me was about strong economy, pro-small business, lower taxes, less government where unnecessary. And I followed that through my life. Relocated a few times, lived in Western Pennsylvania, lived in, came back to Jersey, to Bergen County, where I grew up. Now I'm in a blue state, feel like a minority sometimes, attacked by my coworkers or family.
What's the heart of your Republicanism? What are the main couple of issues or values that define your Republicanism, and whether there's a female component to that, since that's sort of the, you know, that's what the PAC is about?
The female component, I'm not sure. I don't really go along with identity politics necessarily. I have never been a mother, but I'm strongly pro-life. I do feel like women need to control their own bodies. So I do believe in the father's rights also. I don't think that's talked about enough. I know some men who have actually, fathered children, and the women have chosen to get rid of that pregnancy. So I really believe in men's and women's rights, human rights. And I'm concerned about being forced to do something against your will, such as maybe bake a cake if it's against your spiritual beliefs. I'm also very concerned about health care. I work in the business, but I've seen people lose their house because of Obamacare, because it was so unaffordable that they couldn't afford the co-pays and the deductibles were so high. So I found the ACA was not affordable health care.
Mm-hmm.
So I was,
you know,
also
people will react
to the Tea Party.
To the Tea Party for tax. I just wanted to follow up on the one point that you made that I know will get a lot of tweets and stuff about, that you would give a man some legal right over a woman's body if she's pregnant and doesn't want to carry it to term?
If he fathered the child, I don't think that child should be destroyed just unilaterally by her choice. If she chooses to bear that baby, then he's financially responsible for the child if it lives. But why should she solely be responsible for that decision of life or death? And then moving on to the Tea Party, I was really attracted to that movement. And contrary to some of the things that you've said on the radio, it's not about race. It was about fiscal responsibility. And it was a rejection of actually George W. Bush's policies. It was born at the end of his administration. And I had gone to a few local meetings in the Bergen County area. And I was really excited. I thought it was going to be a bipartisan movement. But it kind of got taken over by a certain wing of the Republican Party, and that was okay. So that's where I'm at.
Carol, thank you so much. We really appreciate you chiming in. So, Olivia Perez-Cubas, we're almost out of time. You've heard some of the callers. You probably relate to some of the callers. I'm curious if you think that there is some unity with Democrats on gender-related issues, sexual assault in the military and who gets to have authority over that, big issue for Senator Gillibrand from New York. I guess the parties are going to divide on abortion rights pretty much. How about equal pay legislation like the Lilly Ledbetter Act and family leave legislation that Democrats want to be more aggressive on requirements for employers than Republican proposals? Any of that that you think unifies the Republican women who've been elected and the Democratic women?
Well, I think for one, I mean, you saw Senator Joni Ernst, who's been a leader on the sexual assault in the military front, along with Senator Martha McSally, who unfortunately just lost her seat in Arizona, but both of whom were victims and survivors of sexual assault. So there are, and that they are two very good examples of why it's so important to have Republican women's voices in the conversation, because you want to make sure that seated at the table is everyone, that women across this country from right to left are represented and their interests are reflected in our laws. And one of the best ways that we can do that is by ensuring that we elect more Republican women. And again, we've come a long way since 2018. It's been a historic year for Republican women. More Republican women than ever before will be in Congress next year. We strongly believe that this is just the beginning and that these women are a testament to the quality of candidates that they were, the quality of the races that they ran. And we look forward to just continuing to grow our ranks.
Olivia Perez-Cubas, Communications Director for the Winning for Women Action Fund, the first super PAC dedicated to electing Republican women on the heels of Republican women's success in the midterm elections for Congress. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.